Hi, everyone, and welcome back to For the Curious and Confused, a podcast for people who want to understand different perspectives of the world through the people who inhabit it. I'm your host, Dom McTaggart, and today I'm joined by Alexandra Docheva. Alexandra was born and raised in Bulgaria to a family of musicians. After earning a bachelor's degree in music from the National Academy of Music in Bulgaria, she came to the United States in 2000. At Louisiana State University, Alexandra earned Doctorate of Musical Arts in Violin Performance in 2007. After spending some time in the Syracuse Symphony Orchestra, Alexandra decided to pursue a career in nursing, which she's been doing since 2011. A few years later, she began her investing career with a focus on real estate and currently owns three real estate businesses and a holistic coaching business. Alexandra's passion for health, financial independence, and her experiences related to cultural integration prompted her to write a book titled It Really Is Simple: A Holistic Approach to Self-Confidence, A Practical Guide, in which she shares her path to success and effort to motivate readers to embrace change and pursue their dreams, despite fear and uncertainty. Her mission is to help people overcome self-imposed limitations, find peace of mind, and acquire prosperity. I'm excited to unpack this set of diverse experiences. So thank you for sharing your time with us today, Alexandra.
Thank you so much for having me, Don. Pleasure to be here.
Very excited. So to start us off, could you give us a 2-minute introduction into who Alexandra is and what motivates her?
Well, Alexandra is a person who wears many hats at once, and that's very motivational because Alexandra didn't used to always be like that. So I was a musician for 26 years before I chose to become a nurse. Very limited mindset, very insecure in many, many ways because I knew nothing else about life. And when I unleashed the passion for nursing and then investing and other things that I also currently do, I was able to overcome the 20-year-old insecurity and lack of self-esteem and self-confidence that was plaguing me for quite some time. And that's why I help now people do the same if they want to.
I imagine if you're existing in this space of music for 26 years, that you have a good amount of confidence in that area, but not as much in other areas. Is that the correct way to understand what you're saying, or is it kind of a holistic lack of confidence that you're talking about?
No, in my case, it really damaged my career, Don, because I had a tremendous stage fright since the age of about 18 or 19. It became worse in my early 20s for whatever reason. I mean, I was practicing. It's not like I wasn't practicing and being dedicated to my profession because ever since the eighth grade, I was practicing 8 to 10 hours a day. So laziness was not the case, but the way I practiced and the mindset involved into my career was the wrong one, which, my parents and my teachers were trying really hard to reverse that mindset of impatience, and they couldn't. Because when you're a teenager who's a little bit rebellious and doesn't listen to the parents, and you think very fast, but when your fingers and hands don't respond technically as fast as your thought process, you become impatient, and then you don't really pay much attention to detail the way you should in order to build your technique in a solid and very lasting way that would give you the ability to perform at 100% or at least 95% of what you were able to achieve in the practice room. So this didn't work out for a very long time. Then a mental history accrued that, it was getting worse and worse, and I would, fail every time I perform. And when I came to the States, actually, I made a lot of progress with my playing, but it was giving decent recitals that were required by my master's and doctoral programs. But when the most important parts came, like auditioning for orchestras, that's where that mindset kept, raising its ugly head. So the other part, to answer your question, insecure in the other areas of life, yes, because I knew nothing else about life. So I really felt stuck in the profession that I wasn't competitive enough, no matter how hard I tried. Yet I didn't have the confidence. And you see, I was being a violinist over 20 years and I couldn't master it. How could I possibly do anything else that people were able to go to school for 3, 4 years and then be professionals in that profession? It just seemed completely unachievable to me at the time.
This conversation is an interesting time for me personally, because I'm finishing up the starting the last year of my program that I'm in, and I'm realizing that I'm one of the senior students in the lab I work in, and I think the lack of confidence is starting to show its head in my regard as well. So I'm curious if imposter syndrome is another way to talk about you mentioning the lack of security in music, because a doctorate of musical performance in violin, that's pretty much sides you can get, but still having this feeling of not being able to perform. Did you ever feel like a fraud in any way? I'm maybe projecting on you a little bit, but how does that land with you?
Fraud is not the exact word. You just feel very discouraged and disillusioned because you put all this work and it doesn't show the way you want it when you're in the most important performance areas like orchestra auditions, where when you audition for orchestras, you want to perform at your best because you're behind the screen for 10 minutes. You pay for your hotel, for your airplane, for your rental car, everything, and you go play behind this curtain in front of a jury that has never seen you before, and you have to be top notch. And it was really just disillusioning. I wasn't a fraud because I had put all the hours and beyond necessary to master the pieces I was supposed to play, but just a feeling of inadequacy, if you would. Okay, and then with the other professions, because you're not a musician, but the other professions, the problem there is that school barely prepares you for the real world, and when you get out into the real world, then you actually learn the profession is a completely different deal from what you signed up for when you started school, because things change so rapidly now, and school always prepares you for the like best case scenario, if that. But that's another topic that we can discuss. It's separate from the imposter syndrome or the feeling like a fraud. It's nothing like that if you put the hours to work and study as much as you could in school.
I'm glad you made the distinction there. Yeah, because I think those can sometimes seem similar, but they are different, and it's important to point that out. So, how did this fit into the experience of moving from Bulgaria to the United States? Because I'm sure that that had its own set of challenges, but how did that map onto your experiences of feeling inadequate in certain ways?
So, I moved from a country where almost nothing was properly arranged into a country where you can have everything because there is so much opportunity. So, there is this sense of entitlement that I had, which was completely wrong, of course, that things would work out automatically soon enough. Well, not soon enough because I was not the fastest of learners. I learned that I had to earn everything despite being in a country that everything is provided, so long as you're willing to work for it and earn it, because there are places that you can work as much as you want and can, but you still won't earn, and manifest what you want because all sorts of circumstances are trying to stop you. But in this country, ample opportunity. I had to get rid of the sense of entitlement that the rich people were supposed to, give to the poor just because they were rich. And I understood that the opportunity was there for everybody. You just have to develop focus, the right mindset. You need to overcome your dread of failure, which I was all plagued by that. I mean, I was all about feeling to fail. Like I said, when I was playing on this audition, there was a constant fear that I would underperform, which always became a self-fulfilling prophecy. You have to change your mindset even in the most prosperous place of the world if you move there, and strip yourself of entitlements and understand that you're just as responsible for your success as everybody else is responsible for theirs. And be accountable and dedicated and just stay focused and not give up. But that really came more with the nursing profession after I changed gears and switched completely the fields, because when I started fresh with nothing that I had any ever studied about medicine or biology properly, it helped me put my own ego and stupidity aside, because when you're dealing with really sick and dying people, you better be able to focus on their needs and leave yours behind for a little while. And that really helped me.
I'm excited to get into the nursing bit, and we'll pin that for a second longer. Were you accepted into the music program you did before you arrived in the United States, or was that you kind of moved to the United States and then decided that's what you were going to do, or were those kind of linked together?
I was accepted in the university before I came to the United States because when you're a foreigner, you don't have the legal right to work. So some kind of a graduate assistantship is what somebody from a very poor country like mine is hoping for, but the school has its conditions. For one thing, I had to pass a TOEFL exam. That's the test of English as a foreign language. They required a pretty high score to pass. They wouldn't accept me if I didn't speak proper English to be a student in America. And that test was really expensive. It was $300, which for my parents was a lot of money. It's not like here in America. And it was my first time ever touching a computer keyboard, Don. I was 24 years old. I had never touched a computer keyboard. I was very behind in these things because all I did was practice violin between four walls. So I passed the test, and then I had to submit, of course, a recording of my playing for the committee at the music school at the University of Louisiana State University to approve my playing to s determine that I was at the level of a graduate student. And then I had to also cram a 1200-page music history page textbook because they wanted to have a preliminary exam to see if I had to be put in a remedial course in music history, or I can go to a 7,000 level class, which was the graduate course. So I memorized that textbook in a matter of 4 months, and I nailed the test when I came to the States. But there were some requirements. They
I can.
really, yeah, they didn't just say, "Hey, come here," and no, there were conditions, and I had to abide by those conditions.
Yeah, graduate studies can be quite a thing to get into. Was your family supportive of that? Or I guess you mentioned your parents paying that $300. How did they feel about you moving
Well,
to the
my
US?
parents had been programming me for a very young age to leave Bulgaria as a violinist. Because we lived in Mexico for 3 years, and then they made a mistake to go back to Bulgaria during communism in 1982 because my mother felt nostalgic. I mean, they had a fantastic life in Mexico City when I was a very little child, but as soon as they realized their mistake, they started really drilling it to me that I had to get out of Bulgaria because it was not going nowhere. So then the regime fell in 1989, and Bulgarians, because that's our, destiny and luck, they completely misunderstood the concept of democracy, where it was thought that you can do whatever you want when you're in a democratic country instead of taking responsibility for your actions and do things responsibly to make the place better for yourself and others. That was not the understanding of most Bulgarians. So the intelligent ones fled the country as soon as the borders were opened, and the not so intelligent ones, we stayed there and just worked our way through this a little bit later. But it was, my parents completely supported. They really wanted me to have a better future.
That's really great. So in terms of the actual program, what is something about getting a doctorate in violin performance that the average person might not know about just going through that process? Because I think people think of graduate programs, they don't think of music immediately, but there's a whole world out there. And so I'm curious
Yes.
what that is
Well, I mean,
like.
you do your own research in music that has not been researched before, composers or authors, I mean, all over the world from different epochs of the Western culture. And you have to give a certain number of recitals, of course, like a soloist. You have to play with an orchestra. You have to support yourself somehow. So the programs that are allowed to pursue as a student when you play in the local orchestras to, pay your rent and whatnot, that's also part of your education, of course, because you're gaining the experience. But the program involves lots of classes, which I personally found mostly not terribly useful to me because I wanted to be a performing musician. And the bad irony was that I had this stage fright, right? So it was a very frustrating time of my life being a music student, although I made very good progress during those years. But still, when the market started collapsing, the orchestra market between 2006 and 2008, when the orchestra started bankrupting all over the place in the United States, I had to do something different because I wasn't competitive enough. And I finally had to wake up. But the program itself, it's academic classes like everything else. And you just study, you practice, and you listen to a lot of music.
Wow. Amazing. So I guess moving into the transition point. So you joined 2006 the orchestra, and then around 2008 or so, that's when everything started going downhill a bit. So I'm guessing that a lot of that was from pressure from the financial situation. But was there like a sense of relief from that part of you that was afraid of failing and having that movement away from performing into nursing? Yeah, what was that transition like from the orchestra into nursing? How did you decide on nursing as well?
Was the hardest thing in my life, that decision, because I knew nothing but music when I was 32 years old, and I realized I was not going to progress well as a musician, and I saw the writing on the wall of our orchestras impeding bankruptcy, which did indeed happen in 2011. By then, I already had a job waiting for me in the ICU upon graduation, but the nursing transition, simply, I wanted to feel useful for the first time in my life to society. It was a profession in demand. It didn't require another 11 years in college, like I had already, passed with my bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees. And I knew that I had a passion for biology when I was a child that I couldn't really pursue because I had to practice the violin. So I thought that might be a good combination. Plus, I knew nobody in the medical field at all. I had no history of failure or success, so I could clear my brain to the best of my ability and start completely fresh. And I really, Don, I was very afraid of poverty because at that point, also my personal life took a downhill. I went through a divorce. And I was really on my own. And so the fear of poverty and that anxiety, I decided to befriend the anxiety for the first time in many, many, many years and turn it into a motivator rather than a foe, like an enemy. A motivator, what needs to be done today, let's do it as soon as possible and then do everything else and just do much more than what's required or expected. Because if you only do what's expected, that's really not enough at all to make your life better. So I went through that transition over the course of the next 3 years.
I like the phrase you said of befriending your anxiety. And this is in no means a simple question, but how do you start to befriend your anxiety? Because I think I tend to have like kind of a background noise of anxiety always kind of there. But how does one go about from making it into this kind of a incessant voice that won't be quiet into, to use your words, to befriend it? What does that take?
Because as you mature, you realize that you have no other choice if you want to move upward in your with your life. And then I started reading books by motivational people, successful people, and I learned that even the most successful people, they constantly have their fears and anxiety, but they did things in spite of them. And that's when I realized, okay, so they're also people, they're human beings. And they do have the fear and anxiety, but they do the things in spite of them, and then to learn to not be afraid of failure. So that's the opposite of academic thinking, right? Because academic thinking, it condemns failure and mistakes, whereas in real life, failure and mistakes is what is the best learning opportunities are to learn from your mistakes and failures. Otherwise, you repeat them. But the sooner you learn from every failure and mistake, the sooner you progress in your life. So that I learned even better when I started investing in real estate. So a little bit later, I needed more maturity in my brain because I told you I'm a slow learner, okay? I'm a very dense student. So it took some time, but with the nursing, it was really a matter of absolutely reversing the course of my life because mentally, emotionally, I was not in a good place. I wanted to be needed, appreciated, and I knew that I had to earn that trust, appreciation of other people by learning the nursing profession really, really well. So I was studying sometimes till 3 o'clock a.m. between I reversed the entire practicing routine. So instead of practicing 9 to 11 hours, I started reading the textbooks 9 to 11 hours before the nursing program even started because I had no scientific vocabulary at all, let alone in English. So all these big books, anatomy and physiology, the chemistry, the microbiology, the psychology, everything I read 2, 3, 4 times from cover to cover before the classes even started. So that's why I was so busy because I was also supporting myself playing in the orchestra. I was teaching violin students, tutoring at the community college. It was a mess of a time, man. It was just ridiculously busy, but it was a great time because my brain finally felt awake for the first time in maybe 15, 20 years, which is scary realization when you're 32, 33 years old to realize that you've been sleeping for the last 2 decades for no apparent reason, but somebody else told you, oh, you should do this, you should do this. That's the best thing to do without you ever really having thought about your own goals and your own priorities in life and what really will be better for you for a change. And it was scary to realize, and yet very inspiring, very inspiring.
That's really great. Yeah, the thing that sticks out for me for that, I'm gonna tell me if this is correct. You mentioned the like waking up from 15 or 20 years, and that almost sounds like that the all that time was fulfilling the expectations that other people had of you rather than fulfilling your own expectations. Is that kind of what the sleeping was like, or was it something different?
Yeah, pretty much that was exactly what it was. Because I can tell you that, for instance, my parents and some friends, but they were very much against me switching professions. First of all, because they felt very guilty that they put me into the music profession and realized I wasn't satisfied in it. And I told them, it's not your fault, guys. I'm an adult person. I can make my own decisions. I should have made that decision way earlier, but I was afraid. So I didn't make that decision when I was 18, 19. Waited till 32. But you learn that Even the most well-intentioned people in your life sometimes really have no clue what the best thing is for you. And you have to learn to trust that feeling because it was the best decision to change professions. It was not easy at all, but it was really the best decision because it gave me so much more opportunity. And I can give you other examples of what they were really against, like my martial arts practice when I told them at 30 I was going to pursue karate, and then did it for 15 years almost. Now, they were very much against that too. I mean, it went great. I earned black belts in the several and a blue belt in another martial art, and I was pursuing it very intense, and that taught me a whole other lot of perseverance, self-discipline, self-respect, respect for others, and all that wonderful stuff that the violin didn't quite do that. Yeah, fulfilling other people's goals just because somehow they convince you that's the best thing for you. Because when we're young, very few of us really can think for ourselves properly and productively. And I surely was not one of those people who apparently was able to early on think for myself and decide, look, this is not the right path for me. So it took a while to realize it.
Yeah, I mean, if you're hyper focused on this one skill for so long, it makes sense that you don't have time really, or like the brain space to focus on other things. So that makes a lot of sense. The martial arts is very interesting. I've been playing around with the idea of jujitsu because there's like the gym I go to right next to there's a jujitsu place, and one of my friends has been doing it and it seems really great, but I just haven't been able to pull the trigger yet. So what has martial arts done for you? And how is that, like the embodiment of movement and like, I guess I'm not sure if you do like, real or like kind of, fake is like fake fighting or like real combat or just kind of movements through that, or what has that been like for you?
So I had a fantastic teacher with his wife. They were both national champions in Okinawan Shorin Goju Karate, and they really taught us some real world skills. So combat, martial arts. See, I guess I'm a female. I strongly believe that every woman should be able to defend herself legitimately. And I'm not one of those who would recommend people to go to just one or two 4-hour self-defense classes, because everybody can learn technique, but the black belt mentality is what was really instilled in me by my masters, Greg Tierney and Judy Mudaferi Tierney. The black belt mentality is something that you carve in your mindset over years, and I say at least 5 years, 6 years, you should do martial arts very dedicated and consciously and deliberately, because it's a commitment. 2, 3, 4 times a week you go there and you really learn what a good teacher pain is, real good pain. It teaches you a lot of skills, and you can inflict pain on others, but you also should learn to be on the receiving end of a really good punch or kick multiple times in a class. And then if you choose to go to Aikido class, then you learn how to fold between 250 and 300 times in a single class. So that's another interesting skill, because the floor is always there for you, and it's a hard floor. So learning and learning. So martial arts for me, that was really the perseverance, respect for others, self-respect was a huge element, and self-control. Mostly self-control, emotionally, physically, mentally. That was the most valuable lesson for me, because you're expected, if you have good teachers, to transfer your knowledge from the dojo into the real dojo, which is called life. And life has much more unpleasant and unexpected challenges than you will ever see in a dojo, especially in America, where lawyers and insurance companies are just waiting for a proper litigation or lawsuit for something, because the parents are very unrealistic nowadays. They expect their kids to learn without getting hurt. Well, that's not really how it works. And my teachers were old school, and we insisted that we're trained old school to the best of their ability. And they had to be very careful with the teenagers and the younger people, because the parents were there and they were super protective. On the other one hand, they were expecting the teachers to discipline their kids, to parent for them. But then if the kids got hurt, oh, that was a bad thing. So the schools nowadays are put in a precarious position. It's not like it was 30, 40 years ago when you went to martial arts, you expect to get hit, you expect to hurt, you expect to get kicked, and you learn from that. It's very different right now, and I could feel the frustration of my teachers. But I managed to hopefully, did my best to extract the old school practice and mindset from them, because I thought that was the most valuable. thing to
Do you still
learn.
practice at all there nowadays,
Oh,
or is
practice.
that
Well, yeah, at home with the boyfriend, we're pretty mean to each other. He was my most
a
uncompromising martial art teacher, but
okay?
we are both fitness freaks. Tons of
Okay.
fitness we do. But martial arts, I still practice the weapons and many of the moves because it's just something that you live with. It's a way of life and it's truly, truly rewarding in the long term. It keeps you focused in a different way. And especially now that I'm pushing 50. Age is measured by mobility. So the more mobile and agile you are, that's how you stay young. And I'm very convinced in that. I will never give it up. Never give it up for as long as I can. Even if I live to 100, I'll still practice martial arts and fitness.
The mobility is such a huge thing. Yeah, my mom is mid-60s, and she, yeah, the always doing the yoga, walking. She gets more steps than I do every day, and yeah,
Nice.
she moves around not like a how old she is. What
Excellent.
weapons do you use for that? I'm kind of curious about the for karate.
So I like the ball stop. I like eskrima sticks a lot.
Can you
Okay.
describe those? I don't think I am
The
familiar with the
eskrima
terminology
sticks,
in
they're
them.
short sticks. They're from the Philippines, I believe, from Southeast Asia. They just short sticks that are very practical. You can do a lot of things with them, and you can use a cane in the same way. You can use any kitchen utensil because you can turn anything into a weapon. Your imagination, the sky's the limit. Okay. So if you can learn to really manipulate one stick very well, you can do this with a ladle, you can do it with a knife, you can do with anything, a fork, doesn't matter. And the best thing, of course, to be able to do is to use your own entire body as a weapon. That's a big priority for me too, because karate means empty-handed after all. So the weapons can be an extension of your body. They can also limit you to an extent. Bruce Lee was against weapons, even though he was a genius with nunchakus, as you know, and other weapons. But he always said, no, the weapon limits you. Your body really should deliver all the pain and damage in the shortest amount of time if you get attacked. Maximum damage in the shortest time frame.
Wow. So interesting. All right, everybody hear that now. Alexander, if you see her on the street, don't mess with her. She knows karate
No,
very
no, no.
well.
We don't go randomly around attacking people. That's what martial arts is about. No. Self-control, first and foremost.
Definitely, for sure. Okay, so moving back to the nursing thing, I should unpack that a little more. Starting 2011-ish, and then now we're at 2025. How has nursing evolved for you in that time?
It's been interesting because, see, my job as a home care nurse, because I spent first a year working night shifts on orthopedic trauma floor, but as a home care nurse, individual one-on-one contact with a patient, my main purpose, just the same with my coaching clients, is to teach the patients how to stop being assets to the healthcare system. Because the chronically sick patients that have one, two, three systemic diseases with potential for multiple organ damage, they are solid assets for the healthcare system and pharmaceutical industry. So when I tell them, 95% of chronic diseases are completely reversible within weeks to months, and they don't believe me, but those who are willing to listen, we can discuss, diet, exercise, and other aspects that reverse a chronic condition that's man-made mostly. The problem is, there's so little knowledge in today's culture about true nutrition, real exercise, and the way the body works in general. And when you combine the health aspect with the financial aspect of life, because lots of people use money as an excuse for not being able to buy themselves really nutritious food, and that's the biggest misconception that I still struggle with many, many patients. It's been an interesting career, and I've learned even more from my patients than I ever learned in nursing school. And I like that because you understand where the healthcare system is going, what to really avoid at all costs, and to hopefully teach those who care to improve their life situations how to avoid these medical treatments that are really not beneficial for them. They sustain the disease, they maintain you. Symptom management, disease management, as opposed to disease reversal and cure. These are very different concepts. It's like going to a financial advisor, Don, and you hand your money to them to manage your assets. And by the time you draw this money out, you've paid 80% to these people in fees, and you only get 20% of your invested money with them at the end. And it's a shock to many people, but healthcare is the exact same way as the financial system, unfortunately.
Could you give us a quick overview? There are two points that stuck out there of the, I think one, things to avoid, foods to avoid. I think we hear the term about like ultra processed food a lot, but if you have any other nuance to add to that, and also the misconception about needing a lot of money to eat healthily. You mentioned that as well. Could you talk on those a little bit?
Well, for one thing, see, my boyfriend and I, we became a whole food organic vegans 8 years ago. Okay, so we ditched all the animal products, and I had stopped meat and poultry in 2000 when I was 24. But he developed prediabetes, and he had high blood pressure and high cholesterol for a very long time. So when he developed the prediabetes, he finally freaked out, right? And I said, let's go plant-based. We're not going to cook with any oils. We're not touching processed foods. We're not touching restaurant food either because it's loaded with salt, sugar, and oil. So no. Our own ingredients, organic fruits, vegetables, grains, and legumes. And guess what? 4 months later, our primary doctor drew blood from my boyfriend again, and there was no longer prediabetes. It was gone. And to the present day, it's gone. So his high blood pressure became normal for the first time in 15 years on that 4 months, 4 month blood draw. And same was true with the cholesterol. It was like halved to what it was before. So I could be the best or the worst person to ask about diet because I'm very strict whole food, organic, vegan. So no animal products. And the most important part is no compromises. No exceptions, no excuses. Okay, it becomes a part of your integrity, especially after you do it for 3 or 4 months and you learn the discipline and you get that pride of ownership of your decision. It becomes a no-brainer. And it's not expensive because we never go to any fancy stores like Whole Foods or whatever to buy meat substitutes or cheese substitutes, which are all made by corporations and they're also loaded with chemicals, fats, and salt and sugar. We don't need any of that stuff. We just buy our own organic fruit, vegetables, rice, beans, legumes, lentils, peas. All these things, when you boil them, if you think about it, just a pound expands two or threefold, so it can carry you through several days with some nice herbal spices. So it's really inexpensive, really, really inexpensive, and highly nutritious. This is why I maintain that it's a complete myth that it's expensive to eat plant-based because we've been doing it for 8 years, and I'm spending, if not more than what I was before, so actually slightly less, sometimes as much, but oftentimes even less than that, especially now that we started last year growing our own organic garden. I mean, he's really doing most of the work there, but it's even more cost effective for the house economy.
One of the things I've heard about for, or maybe I think about when I think of having your own garden, is that it seems like there's just such a long period of time between like planting something and then being able to have and eat and harvest it. How does that time scale work for you guys on
Well,
providing your own?
he planted the squashes here in January, February. Now we're ripping these huge butternut squashes. It's June. Now, soon enough, the harvest will stop because in Arizona it becomes very hot, 115, 120 degrees. So in those temperatures, we're not going to grow the vegetables, but we go grow inside vegetables in those temperatures, right? But the outside, if you start them early enough, we have like now pounds and pounds of cucumbers, peppers, lots of spices. It's really, really nice. And he's still in a learning curve. This is his second summer doing this. We had tons of fantastic organic lettuces for a month and a half that grew between March and May. And compared to last year, his harvest now is like tenfold compared to last year. Because he keeps researching and he keeps adding little bits here and there within the frustration of not succeeding when he wants to. But I keep reminding him, look, it's so much more successful than last year. And this is your second summer in freaking Arizona, man. The worst climate. We just planted a lemon tree. We're going to plant a fig tree. I mean, you gradually develop that ecological environment in your backyard that creates the shade for the more sensitive plants. And eventually you'll have a fantastic garden after 4 or 5 years if you're willing to learn that. It's like with everything. Just put the hours and the focus in it. And then it becomes even more cost effective for the household.
That's a really nice vision. Best of luck on that. I'm already imagining everything getting larger and lusher, and that sounds
Yeah,
really great. And
it does.
especially
It does.
so great that he also was able to reverse his pre-diabetes as well. So everybody
Thank
listen
you.
up for that. Lots of beans, lots of legumes and vegetables. Okay, so to pivot briefly again, so you mentioned real estate as well.
Real
I
estate.
think up to this point we've had kind of a this has seemed kind of, holistic and like you're making very intentional choices. And I think when people don't typically associate that with real estate, I think it's very common to think of like, the guy in the button-up shirt and like going to meetings and stuff with real estate. So how What was your introduction to real estate, and how has your experience been in
So
that space?
here is, in a nutshell, the holistic approach to self-confidence. So you treat your health, you optimize your health to the maximum. You choose a career when you can be as useful to society as possible, so you stay relevant, and you learn marketing skills at all times so that you can again stay relevant and needed and sought after and appreciated and work for as long as you want, if you want. Now, the financial aspect, it's different from the career aspect. The financial aspect, you learn the financial discipline to save money, to invest it in tangible assets that will produce monthly cash flow regardless of whether you work or don't work. That gives you the choice to continue working or stop working, start your own business. It's your choice, but it gives you choices. And when you have a choice with multiple cash flowing assets that you built over the course of 5 to 10 years, then the job that originally seemed daunting and oppressive might not seem so bad because you can leave it at any time, yet you still feel appreciated by your coworkers and your clients, in my case, my patients. Okay, and you stay longer because you've learned something that you was valuable and still very valuable, and you can provide value to society. At the same time, you have cash flow. So this is a very important part of the holistic self-confidence approach. And I disagree when people consider holistic just from a health perspective or emotional or mindset perspective, because money is a very important part of our lives. It gives us the choices where we go study, where we go travel, what we eat, who we meet and who we don't meet if we choose not to meet. It's just such an ample choice when you are completely financially independent. And I've told people I don't have a 401k. I would never hand my money to some active mutual fund managers who may manage or mismanage my money. And I have absolutely no control over my investment. All of my investments are in real estate. I also am a very, very passionate options trader. So that's another way to produce cash flow. But it is a very important part of the holistic perspective because you just feel so much more in control of your life, of your own life, and your choices, and who you listen to or not listen to. It's made a world of difference, a world of difference. And it started because I saw, as a nurse, very quickly, first of all, I saw what the healthcare system was really all about, how much facade, what was behind the facade of the healthcare system. And then I saw the burnout rate in many nurses. I saw lots of extremely sick healthcare professionals, physically, emotionally, and mentally. And those were the very people who were teaching others how to live healthy. So it didn't make any sense. And you have no credibility to teach people if you are sick yourself. So you can't do that, sincerely. And it was just a big cultural shock. And I then became curious about finances and said, what if I add that to my nursing knowledge so that I really can have more choices and do more things with my life and just be more independent in more ways and more adaptable? And it was, again, another excellent decision. Now, that decision, my parents didn't opposed because they had no clue about all that financial aspect, but lots of my friends, mind you, said, oh no, you're gonna lose all your money. This is extremely risky. This is a horrible idea. You gotta work, keep working and save. And all that's crappy advice, right? Because they had no clue about finances. They're not the musician friends. What do they know about finances? So I didn't listen to them either. Okay, that's another way to make your anxiety a very good friend, because you're afraid of losing your money, but then you say, okay, how can I do so I really learn that investment vehicle so well that I'm in control, I can calculate my risk, I can manage my risk appropriately, and still be very financially independent and produce the cash flow. And again, it worked very well, but it was another learning curve.
That was my next question for your. I'm assuming that once you get two or three properties, you kind of have a flow of kind of how it goes. But
Yes.
could you talk a little bit about what options and what kind of factors you were thinking about when you bought your first property, and what you learned from that first experience of doing that?
So first of all, I bought mentorship in real estate from a self-made millionaire because I started with nothing in this country, and I wanted to learn from somebody who had nothing at first and then became a self-made millionaire. That only made sense to me. So that was the person I learned from. The consideration was that I had been a tenant for 14 years before I bought my first investment property. So I decided to use the most economical loan, which is an FHA loan. It was a building with four apartments, a fourplex. So we lived in one of the apartments as first-time property owners and we rented the other three. The problem with that was that we had never owned a property and now we had a quadruple problem. So instead of one air conditioner, there were four air conditioners. And guess what happens with air conditioners in Arizona at 115? There were summers of 124 degrees, you know, two,
Oh.
3 days. So the air conditioners start talking and then you have five water heaters, four apartments and a shared laundry room, water heaters. Then you have all of the appliances are quadrupled, so if anything breaks. So it was an interesting, very, very fast learning curve. So that first property was it's always the steepest experience. And then every next property is easier. Okay, but you learn something new from each property. So it's never the same with every property because you get a different lender, different products available on the market, things change all the time. So you get used to that constant unknown and you adapt to it and you tailor it to the best of your ability to your current situation because the conditions are never ideal. Okay. Now, the other consideration was we needed to choose a property that wasn't in the high end of the bubble because when I started investing in 2014, so the market had crashed in 2008. We were already 6, 7 years into the bubble, right? Now it's at its height, so I wouldn't buy properties now, but then it was still doable. The challenge was that with each next property, we had to move further and further west because they were cheaper further and further west and they became more expensive the closer to Phoenix it was. So you calculate the market, you understand the rents, and there are other considerations also, but it's a lot to learn. So I wouldn't do it if I have no clue about finance or real estate. I wouldn't do it on my own ever without mentorship.
Yeah, I do hear a lot. That's something that comes up a lot, like the mentorship, that and networking, I feel like are the two things that I hear so much about. But I'm glad it's been able to work out so well for you, and I thank you for the unpacking a little bit of that. So to pivot a little bit, I'm curious about what kind of lessons you've learned throughout your life, and particularly, are there any that have kept coming up over and over again that you're like, oh, that is such an important lesson, and then it comes up later, oh, it's still really important. What are the sort of things that kind of keep popping up in how important they are?
Yeah, you really have to understand that people will disappoint you no matter what. And you never attach yourself to most people in your life because they always mind their own best interest. So you can over-deliver to people, you can really do your best to serve the best you can, but never expect anything in return because you'll be bitterly disappointed. So that was my thing earlier in my life, and now I'm very good at it. I never expect anything from people and it's worked excellent for mutual benefit because way less disappointments, and there is much more time to focus on my activities that matter to me at the time. Working with people has always been challenging for me. It always will be in many ways because how to explain that? I don't know, but I used to be a very attachable person when I was younger, and I got burned so many times that now I don't want to attach myself at all, if possible, unless we find really common ground in business or in other areas. But it has worked well for me. So, one very important principle, I never do business with friends or relatives. Absolutely never. And I know it has worked well for some people, but I've seen it too much fall apart. And I have had bad experience with relatives. My parents have had very bad experience with relatives, not even trying to do business together, but like basic relationships. And I really have vowed to myself I will never do business with friends or relatives. Okay, so if somebody who is a budding entrepreneur is listening to that, be very careful because the closer the person is to you, the more disappointing it will be if things don't work out. And that shouldn't deflect you. It shouldn't ruin your focus from your mission, from your vision, and from your dream if that business is so important to you that you really want to keep it in spite of who you're working with. And you have to replace a person who is not loyal or doesn't show the integrity that you expected and that was promised.
Yeah, the aspect of expecting to be disappointed, that seems, I guess you could say it's a realist approach, maybe to an extent, but also, yeah, definitely making sense with somebody who has, in your case, been burnt several times by that.
But it's also self-defense mechanism. It's a self-defense mindset to never expect to, always have blind loyalty, always have people to jump at your expectations, at your needs. Just you have to be flexible, you have to adapt to their lack of enthusiasm to work or do something for you, even if you pay them very well. Okay, so that same applies with my contractors that I work with, every respect, insurance agents, accountants. It's just one of those things that you realize people have their own priorities. You're not their priority. Nobody cares about you at all. And if you don't manage every aspect of your business and life, you will probably not go as far as if you rely on others to handle things for you.
Yeah, that is a pretty valid framework. I think the one question you have, I think you mentioned this a little bit also, is the sometimes you have difficulty working with people. So how has that mindset impacted your ability to connect, not in like a business context with people, if that is something you're open to talking about a little bit?
It has really forced me to understand their perspective better before they even unveil it to me. And it has forced me to be a better communicator. It has forced me to show much more understanding to their needs and really a tolerance to their lack of desire to do certain things at a certain time. Okay. If it's not going to work now, maybe a little bit later. Now, if it doesn't work out two times, then we're not going to give you a third chance and then we'll call somebody else. But not taking it personally, also, it's very important. And that helps with distancing and detachment. See, in my career, for example, unfortunately, because as a home care nurse, I barely see my colleagues ever. We communicate via email. I see the patients a couple of times, and it really is not like I get to hear all their gossip and personal stuff, which I absolutely don't want to hear when I'm working. And I've made it very clear, guys, I don't want to know your personal problems. I don't tell you my personal problems. We're working here for the benefit of our patients. Well, not all of them like that. Well, too bad. So you put these limits on people. So you have to know how to put limits. I mean, you also have to be respectful because you never know what they're going through at any given moment. And you assume they're having their own struggles. Everybody is, give them a little slack every now and then, but also be very clear and firm in your expectations of the people and what you will deliver in return for them matching your expectations. It's a constant game of respect and mutual limits and understanding.
I think it's a great segue into the next question, which is kind of related to that. I think this is interesting just from your experience as a person in life, but also as moving from Bulgaria as well. When you kind of see the current culture that we're living in 21st century America, what is something that you feel like is contributing to the increased division that we seem to be seeing in the general population? And is what can we do as individuals to start to address that and kind of have more of that respect that you're talking about for each other at a kind
Well,
of
people should
practical
stop
level?
expecting others to fix their problems for them, especially the government. And governments have their own agendas. People need to become much more self-reliant. They need to be willing to learn and change and adapt rapidly to situations, be more marketable, and be more mentally mobile. I'm not saying ethically flexible. That's not what I'm talking about at all. But truly, the lifelong learning aspect, I find lots of people being extremely lazy to learn new things. And that is not doing them any good favor at all. And there are people who are slightly younger than me. They still live in the industrial age when it was considered that once you're out of school or college, you've learned everything you need to know and then you're good with a job. That is absolutely not the case right now. So people really need to become more self-reliant of their own accord. Okay, of their own accord, because it seems like a ton of people are really relying on somebody else, the government, their employer, who nonprofit organizations to solve their problems. That is not how it's going to work. And the more self-reliant you become, the more respect you have for yourself, the more independence, the more confidence, and the more respect for others who are just as self-reliant as you are. And then people will connect better because they will know that the purpose in life, the focus is what matters. And what you do for others and other petty things just will stop mattering. Politics, even, because I don't know. I've never really been completely immersed in politics because I'm focused on my tasks and goals and values. And the people who talk politics most, they really don't like, they don't do very much. Just it's like discussing each other's personal lives for no apparent reason over 2 hour coffee when you could be learning so much, especially in the information age. I mean, the knowledge is on our fingertips right now with a computer. There's a ton you can do for yourself. So when people are divided for whatever reason, they don't realize that each side of this political spectrum has its own corruption, its own lies, and the goal is to control us all to the best of their ability, while they can do things behind the curtains that we will probably never be able to see unless it's some leak happens, and then who knows what's going to be done about it. So I would never suggest that people follow blindly one party or one guru or one leader for just because their parents did or their friends are. You always have to think for yourself because things change in politics, parties change, people change in parties. You cannot blindly follow something just because somebody told you it was a great idea. Think for yourself and then you won't be as divided. I find that people who think for themselves are able to be much better friends even if they have their differences. They're better able to respect their differences because they actually have found their own paths with independent thinking rather than clinging to somebody else's opinion and for dear life because they don't have their own insights or, the courage to find out what really is their truth because everybody has a different path to their own truth in life.
Yeah, definitely the not tying your identity to a set of ideas and being able to be flexible. What I hear if you is pull yourself up by your bootstraps and be able to think critically. Those are very important aspects. Well, this has been really awesome. One last question for you is just, is there any last piece? I think we might have covered a lot of this in this last bit here, but any last pieces of advice that are important to you that you'd like to leave the listeners with? Maybe it could be similar to that or anything in a more holistic sense.
Usually, I see people always find these excuses with their unique situation, why it wouldn't work for them, for whatever reason, with their health, their career, the finances, the relationships, prioritizations. Everybody's situation is different. And while this is nice, your experience is different, but it's not an excuse for not moving forward with your life and changing it for the better if you know that you have all these problems and you need to first solve before you can solve the problems of your real goals and dreams. Okay, if you're stuck in a situation, you have to have an honest conversation with yourself. And that is truly, it's not just one aspect of your life. Like I see with my patients all the time and my clients, my coaching clients, they either have a very crisis in relationships, a crisis in finances, or crisis in health, or two or three together. And that also affects their careers and their spiritual life, obviously, and mental health and emotional health. So the holistic approach to me, and that's what I always urge my clients to do, you have to work on all these five aspects at the same time together all the time. Because it's all a work in progress, and you have to stay extremely vigilant and never get lazy with any of these pillars of your life, your health, your spirituality, career, finances, and relationships. Because if you constantly work on them, in 5 years from now, you won't believe how far ahead you have gone compared to your friends and other people around you. And it's more than possible. And I'm telling this because I'm somebody who never believed I could change in any way at all for more than 2 decades. It was a very self-inflicted lack of self-esteem. And if I can do it, I tell everybody in my book, I've said hundreds of times, if I could do it, you can do it. It's not a mystery. It's nothing complicated. It's just truly make up your mind and get going and take action.
Take action. There you go. Yeah, thank you. That's a great piece of advice to leave us on. Well, Alexandra, I really appreciate your insights and all these questions, and thank you for sharing so much about your life and experiences. So, really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me, Don. It was a pleasure. Pleasure talking with you.